Hello, welcome back, everybody, to another year of the Sunday Podcast.
I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Back in 2025 for our fifth season. You can expect more of this.
He's claiming that he was ill before the semifinal, whatever. But, you know, I just feel like at that point he was just looking for attention.
And some of this.
And you normally say no human is limited. So I can't limit myself, or I can't just say I can do.
As well as event coverage around all the major races on the UK circuit.
And if you're a fan of the pod, please give us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service.
And if you want to stay up to date with all the latest news, give us a follow on Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
As always, thanks for listening. See you next time. And we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hello and welcome back to another episode brought to you by sportsshoes.com. As always, in this week's episode, we sat down with New Mexico head coach Darren Gorson. Darren is one of very few British coaches currently working in the NCAA, and he took over the Lobos in 2023. We talked about his coaching journey so far, from working as a grad assistant at Butler to his goal to retain professionals at New Mexico alongside the college team in the future, and of course, everything in between as well. Enjoy this one, and we'll catch you guys very, very soon.
Okay, first off, Darren, just welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on. Where are you joining us from today?
I'm just in my office today. Yeah, I was just watching the sub-4 attempt and not venturing too far. I'm normally taking a little bit of a break or hitting some holidays over the summer, but my wife's actually pregnant and we're expecting on Monday. So it's going to be, I'm not going to be able to go too far, which obviously, it's amazing having, you know, birth of our first child coming along. But we've got a lot of people competing this summer in different countries. So it would have been cool to head out over the next like 4, 5, 6 weeks.
Yeah, well, congrats, mate. And obviously, thanks for finding the time to chat to us during that as well. But look, as we said, right, Fake Yeagon's just gone for that sub-4. What do you make of events like that I guess very different from the races we see on the circuit, but even more so maybe than from the NCAA?
Yeah, I mean, anything that's going to grow the sport. I remember watching the sub-2 attempt with Elliot. That was really cool. And this sub-4 attempt was awesome as well. It just shows you know, you're pushing the human limits all the time, and if you can do in that kind of setup, then obviously eventually in the next like 5 to 10 years, if someone will do it, and then once that barrier is broken down, like Roger Bannister back in the day, once it's done once, and now, you know, it was a huge thing on the men's side, even in the NCAA for me and I remember my brother breaking 4 and not making it to NCAA indoors. And now we've got women attempting sub-4. So it's pretty special for the sport. And I just talking to a few of our athletes today, I know they were tuning in and excited to watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that women are going to attack that mark now for so many years to come. I'm not sure, you know, anyone can quite replicate Kip Yeagon's efforts. She is just once in a generation, I think. But cool to see, that's for sure. But let's move on with yourself, and let's start with your background, Darren, because we were just talking and you can clarify this for us, but you're pretty much the only British coach in the NCAA, and you really have gone through the ranks there. But let's start right back at the beginning. How you got into running first, and how did it all start out?
Yeah, back at Edinburgh AC, Dave Campbell, back Meadowbank, in the old Meadowbank, back in those days, 16, 17, 18 years old. And, you know, all the way back to primary school and high school running in Scotland. Yeah, at the time, I mean, there wasn't the depth and the strength of Scottish distance running, middle distance running. That was like, late 90s, early 2000s, and managed to win a couple of senior Scottish championships back in the day and be one of the strongest Scottish runners back then at like 3:44, 3:45, which is crazy, but 15 seconds too slow for, you know, your Neils and Josh and Jakes and everyone else that's competing for Scotland now. All the way back then. And Dave Campbell learned a ton from him. I mean, he's coached some amazing athletes. I remember going back to Scotland and seeing a, you know, a young Chris O'Hare, a young Josh Kerr, and my brother was pretty good, not quite at that level, but he worked with a lot of elite athletes in Scotland coming through. The time he was retired in his 70s, and you know, we did some Highland Games and some other stuff. We were just kind of venturing a little bit more into like the BMCs. I think I was probably one of the first where I'm like, all right, hey, I'd like to compete a little bit more in Europe. Yeah, at that time there wasn't really a ton of Brits or Europeans in the NCAA in the, you know, the early 2000s. But yeah, I remember getting in contact with a few people. Andrew Lemoncello, probably, I don't know if you remember that name, yeah. Steve, he went to Florida State. Luke Gunn, who were about the same age, went to Florida State as well. So I only knew about like three universities back then that you could go to, or didn't have any idea of the size or the scale of college athletics back then as well. So I remember, yeah, shooting a message to Iona, Providence, Florida State, and to talk to Joe Franklin at Butler. He was the coach there. And then, we had Scott Overall was at Butler at the time. He was like a year in front of me. One or two others, Ollie Laws, who works for On now. So, yeah, kind of followed those guys and went to Butler University to do my master's. Did my undergraduate at Napier University in Edinburgh. So I was just heading over to get the master's, get a little experience of what the NCAA is all about. And it was a lot different back then, that's for sure.
Wow, you've just named a whole host of our previous podcast guests. So
there you go.
Joining some good company there. But some people, I guess, growing up and kind of competing in athletics, they always kind of had a bit of a coach in them, if you like. And we speak to some people and they're like, I was always tinkering with my own training, or I was kind of giving advice to others. Is coaching something that you kind of felt like you had in you at a kind of a younger age when you're running, or is it something that post-running you kind of lean more towards?
Yeah, I always like really, really enjoyed coaching and wanted to be involved. I was a big football guy in Scotland and really wanted to. That's where my original passion was. And played for some teams and did some trials at Raith Rovers, which is a small team in Scotland. So I was really a lot more involved with like club teams, rugby, things like that. So not really. My brother started athletics, track and field at a younger age. But for me, it was more, I did a lot of other sports and then focused a lot more on running when I got to like 18, 19. So I really wanted to go into like being a football coach. So I'm just obsessed with, you know, I think I've read everything on Sir Alex Ferguson, big Mourinho guy, obviously Pep. So I was really just loved a lot of leadership stuff. I'm a big business person as well. So really try and read a lot of different things on business leaders and CEOs and everything. But yeah, for sure. I was probably a really annoying athlete for Dave Campbell back in the day, because I would always be asking about different workouts, different types of training, and you know, why can we do this or why do we not do that? Probably someone who, if I had to coach me, I'd be like pulling my hair out, having to have a talk with myself. But that's who I was. And yeah, I was definitely very interested in leadership positions, or like I said, football coaching, or you know, running a company. I'm not very good at really. I wouldn't be great at probably working for someone else. So being in charge and being a head coach really, really kind of suits my skill set. So I'm really involved in just everything in sport and leadership. So it just kind of was a natural movement for me, I think.
That's interesting. Your interests first started out, you know, look at reading about leadership styles and athlete communication. And I was going to say man management. That's a bit of a football term, isn't it? But I think me and Ollie do always have this debate as well. And I think that a lot of people assume to be a distance running coach, you need to know your physiology. You know, you need to know your science. You need to know that side of the game. And I think it's starting to, I think people are appreciating it more and more, but actually so much of it is down to communication. Would you agree with that?
Totally. I think, you know, coaching, especially for me now at the University of New Mexico, coaching is a smaller part of like the bigger picture of what I do on a week to week, month to month, because there's a lot of different things that go into being a head coach. If it's managing the budget, or I was talking to someone the other day about managing up, working with your athletic director, your sport oversight, being really involved with your athletic trainers. There's a lot of different areas: budget, travel, compliance, recruitment. So coaching, that's the part I love, and I'll never go away from, being more of a director and just handing off the coaching side of things. But yeah, there's a big part of we I talk all the time in our in our staff meeting about what is our principles, what are our just our non-negotiables of who we are as a program, who we are as coaches, and what we're going to allow from, members of the team, and what are the things that we're not. Because you're constantly, I think, as a head coach and even as an assistant coach, for me as a younger assistant, you're going to get tested quite a lot from athletes or from assistant coaches on, hey, can I go over here and do this? Or can I change things a little bit differently? Can I train on my own? Or can I go with the men today? Or hey, can I cut this a little bit shorter? So you've constantly got, I think, decisions to make on what you want to do. A lot of day-to-day things as well, like decisions on what are you going to allow people to miss class and still compete? Are you going to miss the allow them to miss class and still train? Are you going to allow them to this is an extreme, but are you going to allow them to, get in trouble with the law and still be able to travel and compete? So these are things that I've dealt with over the last 17 years of NCAA coaching of, what is your team? What is your principles? What are you going to, what is your non-negotiables as a team and as a program? And how do you want your athletes to interact with one another? And how do you want them to interact with the coaches? So yeah, going back to like the football coaching and the other leaders, those are really key things, because if you have all those things in place and the athletes really know of, okay, hey, my mom or my dad can't just drop the coach an email and be like, hey, needs more 150s. Then, that's a thing for us where we really don't talk to parents on training or play time or travel or things like that. We'll maybe discuss a little bit scholarship stuff at the end of the year, but we don't really involve parents and the coaching side of things. So there's a big thing on what you're gonna allow and what's your program all about. It's so different to the UK and how I would coach if I was in the UK, because you just don't really need to worry about some of those things. Or if I didn't show up for training with Dave, he'd probably shoot me a text saying, where are you or whatever. But here, if you don't show up and you don't communicate that, what are the repercussions for that? What are your team rules for missing training or miss it, being late for the bus? All those little things we have here, which I didn't experience any of that in Britain. It was just more of a club, more free. So there's definitely advantages to both sides of it. Here, we're obviously there's more of a financial implication of, hey, we're paying you $49,000 for a full scholarship. These are the things that we're requiring out of you for that scholarship. Whereas in the UK, we weren't meeting for Wednesday runs or Mondays or whatever. Or if we were rocked up a little bit late from a lecture at university, it was just like, hey, just warm up and you'll jump in the session when you can. So it's really different. I've just totally gone on a tangent here. So apologize if I continue to do that.
No. I think it's so important to, I guess, lay that context to chat to you in this podcast, because the NCAA and like you've just described, is probably the only thing I can think of in terms of track and field anyway, where you as a coach are like football coaches are, who have a roster of athletes. You're picking a team, and I guess you have all the power in that sense. Whereas you talk about back home, whether it's kind of grassroots or even pros. Pros are hiring and firing coaches and saying, "I believe you can take me to the Olympics." Whereas it's the opposite for you, right? You're saying,
"Yeah,
okay, join my team," and then
Yeah, I mean, you know, my first head coaching job at Bradley, first time being in charge of the whole program is I was at Lamar before that. But yeah, you're choosing who you want to coach, who you want to recruit, and investing scholarship in them. It could be $1, it could be all the way up to a full scholarship. And then, hey, if we're gonna invest, here's what we're looking for you to do. But other coaches are different. I'm very structured. We have a pretty disciplined approach, but I've got good friends of mine that are, you know, they're a little bit looser with their setup of their team, of what they're, you know, what they allow or how many practices they have. You know, Joe Franklin's a really, really good friend of mine, and he coached me and brought me to Butler, but he's been hugely successful. He was the coach here before me, two national championships, and we got a ton in common, but our styles are a little bit different in how we, you know, approach our week of training and the structure of everything. He's a little bit more individualized. It flows a little bit more, whereas we're kind of like team a lot more. Hey, if one person's doing this, everyone's doing the same thing. We're going to warm up the same. This is our drill set. Everyone's doing it. This is our pre-race drill set. Everyone's doing it. It's non-negotiable, and so on and so forth. So it's just different people have just some different styles. But what I want to have as a coach is feel like people are going to come into our program and be like, hey, I'm part of a team. Have Tom Samuels not training at 6 a.m. and then I don't see him and he's just kind of doing his own thing. And then the rest of the team meet at 8 a.m. You know, he shows up at the same time as everybody else. It's the same level of requirements that are out of him. And lucky for us, and you know, he loves that. He doesn't want to be treated any differently. I think, you know, a lot of our elites are the same way. It's if one person is training really hard and doing everything right, and it should, you know, setting an example for other people, it's gonna, you know, just raise the bar and raise the group overall, and we'll continue to improve as a program. So yeah, those are just a few of the little things that are different here compared to, like you said, in the UK, and how we're, you know, recruiting people who we want. And yeah, it's obviously changed a ton in the last few years with the transfer portal, and, you know, people are coming and going a little bit more in programs. We've been really lucky to have great retention, and but it's just really changed a lot, and it's changing a lot this summer with the roster limits as well.
Yeah, so the roster limits, will they affect you?
Yeah, they're going to affect. I mean, we had 63 women on the team last year, and we unfortunately had to cut quite a few, and we didn't recruit a big class because we knew the 45 was going to come in, so we'll be at 45. The great thing for us in New Mexico, we're going to get more women's scholarships, so the numbers will be smaller. The amount of money that we have and scholarship opportunities we have is gone up a ton. So the thing you'll see even next year with our team is the numbers are a little bit smaller, but the overall quality of our team is going to be even higher. You know, we've got the French U18 record holder coming in the 453 low. We've got some great high jumpers and long jumpers, and, you know, some really good middle distance athletes coming in. So our overall program will be a little bit stronger. We will have no walk-ons on the women's team next year. It'll be only scholarship only. So wow. Definitely a little bit different to what was like before.
Let's talk about the program, because obviously big news, was it this week or last week? Was it Washington State decided they're just going to double down on distance and just forget every other event in track and field? And people do associate New Mexico as a distance school, right? Cross country. And like you said, when you went to NCAA track, I think you scored all your points in the 5 and the 10, maybe a steeple as well. But interestingly, you are looking to recruit in the track space as well and other events.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably another thing for me just as a coach. When I first took the job here, I remember saying pretty early, or I even said to the athletic director here, I was like, hey, if you hire me, I'm trying to win all six conference championships. I just can't, you know, indoor and outdoor track, that's like 6 months of the year. So going to conference or going to NCAA indoor and outdoor and feel like we're competitive as an overall track program would be really, really hard for me as someone who's extremely competitive. So we want to have a complete track program, and we've been able to, you know, the women won the first time in school history. We were on cross country, indoor and outdoor, and then the women finished top 10 at outdoor track. So we want to continue to do the whole thing. It's a little bit trickier on the man's side when the roster is going to be smaller. You know, Brody Young, 45 seconds in the 400. We have the number four ranked American 400 runner coming in, Valen, 45, 61 in high school, 218 high jumper. He was at World Juniors from South Africa coming in. So we're going to be stronger in track and field. Yeah, it definitely makes it a little trickier.
I just have a quick question here. Were you ever an assistant coach? Because, you know, with someone who is so passionate about leading, you kind of want to direct and steer the ship, and you're doing a fantastic job in New Mexico. But was there a period where you were assistant coach early on in your coaching career and you're like, just chomping at the bit to make, I guess, more of a difference? You kind of had to just be a bit of a yes man for a period.
Yeah, no, I did. I'll go all the way back. I ran at Butler University. So then Joe left to go to New Mexico. I had one more year left at Butler, and Matt Rowe came in from Long Beach State. And then after that, I kind of in my last year coaching at sorry, competing at Butler, he didn't have as much experience with international recruitment as what Joe had. I put him in. I knew a lot of some of them were my friends or my brother's friends at the time. Rob Mullet, my brother was just finishing university at Edinburgh, so he came to Butler. Rob came to Butler. He went on to, you know, the Olympic Games and the steeplechase. Andy Baker was already there, but incredible cross country runner. So I went from being an athlete, and then Matt Rowe was incredible. He, you know, hired me as a part-time assistant coach at the time. So my assistant coaches are probably sick of me telling the story, but that first year I made 6,000. I made 6,000 there. I was still trying to run a little bit, which was dumb, but made 6,000 there. I was a substitute teacher, which I tried to do in the morning and the day to make some money. And then I coached some middle school athletes in Indianapolis at the time to make a little bit more money, just to piece everything together. Then I still tried to run. I don't know how I can't even think about trying to do something like that anymore. But I was just, the money was not really, I didn't really think about it. It was just a great opportunity. So in my first year of coaching, yeah, 6,000. And then I just really took the reins on a lot of the recruitment. So there did a lot of the women's recruiting in Butler, same on the man's side, just, you know, really got into the international recruitment part and really wanted to own that space. So that's where I picked up Callum Hawkins, Ross Clark. I'm going all the way back here. Kirsty Legg, Katie Clark, some of my first recruiting class. They came into Butler, did really well, and the women improved and improved. Again, Matt Rose, incredible coach, still is at Butler. And I left, and then the women went on to finish third in the country at Butler. But yeah, really owned a lot of the recruitment part in my time there, and learned a ton from Matt Rowe and his coach. You know, I'd seen Joe's, I'd seen Dave's, and then it was a chance to see Matt's, who he's worked and coached a lot of really, really good athletes at Butler, and they're still, you know, constant, you know, in the top 25 in cross country, really good distance program. So learned from him. I was in that role, and then kind of he slid me up over time. I was part time, then I was making, I think, like 16,000 in year two. Then I made 24,000, so making enough to kind of survive and pay the bills. And then at the end of year four, probably to answer your question there, you know, like at the end of year four, I was just desperate to lead and to run my own program. I probably was at that point. I don't know. Just going back a little bit. Hopefully I wasn't stepping on his toes or like that. But I definitely had that urge just to, hey, I just want to coach my own group, recruit my people, and just really be in charge. So interviewed for a few jobs and just was not getting them. And then luckily, Lamar University popped up, and Trey Clark, who's still a great friend of mine, and he hired me at Lamar. So jumped down to Beaumont, Texas, and got the Lamar job, and was there for 3 years. But that was probably, Yeah, I started coaching Sam Stabler there. He went from 1450, and then in my last year with him, he ran 1330. You know, he was the NCAA lead before Super Shoes and won the Stanford invite. And I coached and recruited Verity Ockenden, who's still doing great, but yeah, brought her into Lamar and one or two others as well, who are amazing. A lot of Brits and, you know, a few Europeans, but really the men were third in the region. The women went from not being in the top 15 in the region to finishing fourth in the region and won four conference championships. It was great. It's the hard, for sure, the hardest I ever worked because it wasn't the easiest place ever to recruit to. And again, I tell them the story as well, because it's so hot there. We'd have practice at 5:30 in the morning, so I'd leave my apartment at maybe 5 or something, and you know, Trey, he's working with sprints in the afternoon, so I'd probably leave my apartment at 5, and I wouldn't get home till like 6 or 7 at night, just recruiting and organizing the team and just obsessive on a lot of the coaching stuff and everything. But yeah, that's where I really, you know, got going on all my coaching and my recruitment and everything. And you know, like, it was a perfect job for me because I think I tell a lot of other, you know, younger coaches coming through, go somewhere where you can make mistakes and you're not gonna get fired, or you're not gonna get crucified for doing it. If I'd gone from Butler to a P5 school, if I'd gone from Butler to, I don't know, Texas or something like that, I wasn't really, I thought I knew what I was doing. But then when I got to Lamar, I made a lot of errors in training, a lot of errors in recruitment, a lot of errors in just operational stuff. So really learned a lot there. And then in the third year, things started to pop up, some opportunities, but really didn't want to go back to being an assistant coach. I had a few opportunities, so probably a bigger assistant coach in some P5 schools, but really wanted to be a head coach at a mid-major program, and applied for two jobs that summer, and then got the Bradley University job in Peoria, Illinois. Went from Lamar back to the Midwest in Illinois and took the Bradley jobs. Yeah, that was kind of the start of coaching and some of the mistakes. And then again, I wasn't perfect to begin with. And you know, being a head coach and, you know, budget, working with ADs and a lot of other things. First time, I think I was one of the youngest head coaches in D1 at the time. So yeah, learned a ton there and had really, really good people around me. Hired some really good assistant coaches as well. Yeah, that was a ton of fun. And then, you know, the men's team had never won a conference championship in 4 years. They finished second in the region, 24th in the country in cross country. So long-winded backstory of like how I got here.
No, it's fascinating though, because like I said, there's very few Brits, well, if any, who have actually managed to have done what you've done.
You mentioned some of those mistakes, right? You think you like if you'd been at maybe a bigger school would have been more of an issue. Are there any that I guess spring to mind in terms of massive learning moments for you, like mistakes you've made in the past 17?
Oh, there's so many. It's hard to go through them, and some I probably don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
No, good question. I think I've got a little bit ADHD. I'm very, you know, a little bit sporadic, and sometimes I'm thinking. So I'll maybe go all in on something and change my mind. And then, so just especially in my younger days, it's just about, you know, take a little bit more time just about evaluating everything of like where someone's going to fit into the team, where their personality is going to fit in, where you see them projected, and so on and so forth. I probably in my younger days just jumped in a little bit too quick on in some recruiting things. I think from just even an operational standpoint, I remember I tell this story, my first couple of weeks at Lamar, I thought Trey was doing a lot of the entries, and we were coming up to pre-nationals, and this is a it's a big deal. I remember freaking out, and I thought he'd entered the team and, you know, obviously hired me to be the head cross country coach. I was assistant track. I didn't enter them. He hadn't entered them. So I'm like freaking out. We already have the flights and set to go to Louisville for pre-nationals. So I called the managed to get the team added in. So ever since that point, I've never missed an entry or, you know, we're all this double check and everything. And I'll even say to our staff, I'm like, imagine being an NCAA regional qualifier or a national qualifier and the coach forgets to enter you. So we have a staff meeting and I make all six of them sign the copy of the entry. So if one I mess up, everybody messes up. So that there's just one story of, you know, messing up on some entry things. And yeah, some training things as well. You know, you're trying to do something that, you know, we did some longer tempos at Butler, and in my earlier days at Lamar, it, you know, it's 36, 37 degrees C, 90-95% humidity, and I'm just trying to rock out 8, 9, 10 mile tempo runs in Beaumont, Texas, which is pretty dumb, and people are just dying of the heat and the humidity. Just change, you know, shorten some things up and made some changes. And, you know, like definitely in those days, like being a younger, you know, I was in my 20s at the time of Lamar, and we had some grad students, so the age difference between me and them was maybe only like 5 or 6 or 7 years. So there'd be a lot of times where you're maybe feeling a little bit threatened. That was my first time coaching my own group, so I have no history of like coaching anybody or any results or anything. So you're trying to get them to buy in, but you don't want to change too much to just accommodate what they're some of the athletes are asking you to do. So it was really an interesting first few years at Lamar of like, okay, am I gonna change these things because they're telling me to change them? But if I do change them, does that mean we're just doing what they want to do and not what I want to do? So you're just, I don't know. I just felt like in a lot of the early coaching days of having not much of a reputation of having coached anybody, I was really thinking a lot about, okay, am I just going to be like, this is what we're doing, non-negotiable? Or is it going to be a little bit softer to where we can do this or this or this? So even then, in my early days of coaching, you're really trying to decide on like how you're going to be and how you're going to manage this group. And then at Lamar, and we did have, it wasn't, you know, we didn't have 100% retention, and you're trying to keep everybody happy as well and make sure you have the best possible team. So you're playing a little bit of that game at Lamar as well of like, I got to give them a little bit of something to keep everybody on board and happy, because we want to be successful. We want the team to have results and have good team chemistry as well. So that was, yeah, it was a big challenge, I think, in my first 3 years. I thought in my time at Butler, I wasn't running the training or being involved. I was very used to being, you know, liked by everybody on the team. I recruited them and I just hand them off to row to coach them, and I'd go get coffee with the guys or, you know, jump in a run with them. It was great. And then being at Lamar and being in charge, and then in those early days of like, these 5 or 6 of these people do not like me, and like, how do you manage that? You know, that I find that really, really difficult in my earlier days of coaching at Lamar, where you're trying to decide, do you want to be like friends with the athletes or do you want to be coach and athlete? So you're constantly, for me, I was like, who do I want to be as a coach, and what do I want to coach this group of people? So I made the decision really early in my coaching career of like, I remember even Matt Rowe, who given me the advice, he's like, always come in a little bit firmer, a little bit more strict. You can always soften up as you go into your time at Lamar. So I really came in pretty hard on everything. And, you know, even then, I remember, you know, Rowe, you know, goes by Coach Rowe. I just went by Darren at Butler. And then I made the decision at Lamar of like, all right, I'm going to be addressed as Coach Gosson. Maybe that'll help with a little bit of the respect and a little bit of the, you know, coach athlete separation. I'm not just one of the boys. I'm actually like, I've been hired as the person who's the leader, and I'm going to be going on a trip to California, and I'm going to be responsible from the athletic department as the person who's going to oversee these people. So, and I do think that's where you see it all the time. Some coaches get into trouble in the NCAA because, in my opinion, we're the coaches and then there's the athletes. I don't think there can be, you can't really get too close in the NCAA because you're going to get dragged into some kind of situation that ultimately a lot of coaches have, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, I've seen a lot of coaches get fired or let go or removed for various different incidents of like, hey, they knew the guys were drinking on a team trip and he said nothing, or so on and so forth. So it's just, again, so different to the UK. I remember going to Bucks cross country and these things were encouraged, right? So it's just you can't, it's so different. It's so different. Like if something like that happened here, I wouldn't last very long.
Wow, that's fascinating. Definitely that dynamic. I think a lot of young coaches will relate, including myself, will relate to that. But yeah, where do you draw the lines? But I think one thing that New Mexico is famous for, and you kind of even pre yourself, but now obviously with your experience with recruiting internationally, how come you don't tend to, I mean, do you recruit in the US? Obviously you have some US athletes, but at the moment, I think I was looking at your roster and it's maybe on the men's side, you've maybe got 8 internationals on that roster. Obviously you have some Kenyans as well. Are you just more comfortable recruiting internationally?
Honestly, coming into University of New Mexico, a ton of history with elite international athletes, Josh Kerrs, Wayne Calades, she's competing for the US, Canadians, Australians, a lot of different athletes here over the years. But coming in here, I mean, on the men's side, we hadn't gone to the national championship in 9 years before I came here. So a little bit of a break from doing that. So we just thought coming in to make an immediate impact, we just got to get the absolute best athletes we possibly can in the door. And regardless if it's America or Kenya or Australia or Britain or whatever. So we just went out, you know, I've got 3 distance assistant coaches and tried to get the absolute best people we could. This is the end of year 2 for me. So in that first year, we brought in a French athlete, Matomo, Evans, Lucas, Hoptum, and then we just built on that in year 2. We brought in some really, really good young American guys who are going to take a little bit of time. Jaden Hernandez ran 14:10 this year. We've got others really improving really quickly. We were able to get a top 10 footlocker guy for this class. So, you know, we recruit the best Americans. They're just, we're maybe not the number one destinations for them to go to. But what we're not going to do is, if we can't get the number one or number two or number three or 10, top 10 American athlete, we can't go back to like number 50 and be like, all right, hey, we got number 50, number 70, number 100, number 156, and sit here talking about trying to win a national championship. So we're, you know, I sent Brian and Kira to World Juniors, and there we were able to get Ishmael Kupkari over the line, who world cross champion. Matthew Koskai took a silver, Marion was silver in the 3K. So we'll go at, you know, we just recruit the absolute best athletes in the world, and now we'll really try our hardest to make more inroads on the top Americans. But we don't you know, we don't discriminate on who we're recruiting or where we're recruiting from. We're just trying to get the best athletes in the world into the University of New Mexico, develop those athletes and be successful. And I think you're seeing that in a lot of other sports as well. I think, you know, you look at Brad Underwood at Illinois, he's bringing in like 5 guys from the Euro League into University of Illinois basketball. There's some other coaches and other sports, golfs, your tennises. They're just bringing in the absolute best athletes in the world into their programs. We're doing the same thing. We catch a little bit of heat for it, but we do what we can to really competitive.
The recruiting is fascinating. I think that's credit to where the NCAA is right now. It's absolutely ruthless. Have you been in a position? I mean, that going to World Juniors last year is interesting. Were you in a position there where you were competing, you were fighting off other unis? What cards do you play in that position, or was it an easy sign for someone like Kipkarui?
Yeah, I think, you know, we it was really hard to get Pamela Koskai here. It was us in a big school in the West. But she decided, just, you know, obviously sister Bridget, world record holder, previous world record holder in the marathon. She wanted to be altitude. She wanted great weather, good coaching. And, you know, you go all the way back to the 60s. There were some great, one of the chairs of Kenyan athletics, Ibrahim Hussein, went to New Mexico back in the 70s. So we've got history of great Kenyan athletes that have competed for the University of New Mexico before Joe Franklin or myself. So I think if you're looking, if you're like, hey, I want to be at altitude, I want great weather, we're the number one choice. Because if you look at Boulder, you look at Flagstaff, you look at Park City in November, December, January, there's like 6 feet of snow in Flagstaff and some of the other places. Whereas here, it could be 9, 10, 11 degrees. We're, you know, in December, January, you know, Josh and Brooks and Puma and Adidas are out on our track doing workouts with t-shirt and shorts on in Albuquerque, and the rest of the altitude hubs are, those guys are on treadmills or on the side of a road trying to hit a threshold where it's ideal for us. That's why we get a lot of pros. I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s, Paula Radcliffe, Bernard Lagat, Hichamel Garouj. This is where they came to train, and when I was in my early 20s. So I think it's coming back a little bit. Obviously, Josh has a house here, is based here 8-9 months of the year. So if you say Josh Kerr enough, people will agree and say, all right, I'm going to come to New Mexico.
I'm not surprised you don't have more people knocking at your door for those very reasons you've just listed. You know, if you really want to become a world-class 5,000 meter runner or 10,000 meter runner, you have got to commit to going to altitude for some large parts of the year. And there's only a few select universities in the US which offer that.
Yeah, there's not a ton. Yeah, Colorado, NAU, Juggernaut for a number of years. Utah on the women's side. So there's not a ton of options, really. Sean, I think, is obviously going to get Colorado cooking here over the next few years, but we're definitely a top option. So no, I think we've made a lot of inroads in the last 2 years, because when I got the job as well, with the portal, everyone, the majority of the team left before I even got here to New Mexico. So I was kind of freaking out that we'd be not very good for about 5 years when I first got here, because we really didn't have much of a team. So but we have some huge advantages. I mean, yeah, the altitude, the weather, and our facilities are really second to none. One of the best indoor tracks in the world, really. We hosted NCAAs 2 years ago. We've hosted USA indoors 5 of the last 6 years, and our outdoor track is only 2 years old. It's awesome. And new weight room, our offices here are, you know, just being upgraded in the last year. So we pretty much have everything you need. You know, 3 boost treadmills, all the kind of bells and whistles a lot of the bigger schools have, which is really nice.
On things like the altitude, how much of an adaptation was that for you coming in as a coach? Obviously, you mentioned when you moved over to Lamar, you kind of tried to replicate what you're doing before, but the heat was an issue. Moving to New Mexico then and coaching at altitude, what changes and things did you make, and how much of a game changer was it for your coaching, I guess?
No, total game changer. And I remember, like, he was really awesome. Remember Josh reaching out to me, and we sat and had coffee for about hour and a half, and talked to some other people that I remember, you know, in early 2000, I'd go Font-Romeu for spring training trip with our group. So I had experience having trained altitude, but totally different coaching a team at altitude as well. So yeah, I going to making some mistakes, definitely made some mistakes in my first year here with some training stuff. And just going a little bit too hard on some of the threshold stuff and some of the interval work this year, especially in cross country. In my first year, we just went just over the edge a little bit. But part of that as well was my first year coaching a new group of people and learning where their edge was, and okay, is this easy for them or is it really difficult? So definitely cooked a few people in my first year of being here, and maybe under trained a few people as well in my first year. But yeah, learned a lot, and yeah, this year I feel like we made some great changes, and you know, to the fall with cross country, and then made even more changes with the track training. But you're always trying to, it's never going to be perfect. There's all this things you're trying to tweak. And it's so hard in the NCAA as well, because here it's cross country, it's indoor, it's outdoor. So there's really no, unless you redshirt some people, which we do, there's not a ton of off season anymore. So it's hard to hit all three seasons. And again, I'm perfectly competitive, so I just want to be really good in all three, and it's hard to do that. This year we probably emphasized outdoor a little bit more than we did indoors, especially for one or two of our longer distance athletes, because we had a little bit of a half an eye on the 10 for Ishmael Haptam and Pamela, which went incredibly well. So we and they didn't run maybe as well as what I mean. Runner up in the 5K, Ishmael was still building really at that point, but yeah, still, you know, making tweaks and learning, and the team was way, way bigger this year as well. So it's hard to, you know, manage a bigger roster this year as opposed to last year, where it was only maybe like 25 people. This year was in the 40s for distance runners, so a lot bigger number.
Wow. And the NCAA is a changing landscape when it comes to cross country. I read an interesting article on you. I think it was even last season going into the cross. I think you're starting to acknowledge and people are starting to realize that you've got to be in probably PB 5K shape, PB 10K shape going into the cross country. Just we was it this year? There was just so many course records. I know it's a weird thing to say on cross country, but it's a thing in America, right? Because the
Yeah.
courses are so well maintained and people are running exceptionally fast over 10,000. And you've had to build in some more speed work. You've had to, I guess, change up that traditional cross country strength training going into the NCAAs now, just because of the
Yeah.
speed they're opening and closing these races.
It's incredible, really. Yeah, I remember it Bradley, my 8 years there. Only in my last year, maybe in my last year, maybe in the last two, did we touch the track at all during cross country. My first 6 years there, when we got 24th, we never went on the track at all during the cross country season. It was just, you know, a lot of base building, long threshold work, and 2K efforts. It was just a lot of aerobic work that we would do. We wouldn't maybe we do a few 200s or something, but we wouldn't ever really get on the track and then. Right around the move around COVID, that shift, I remember watching Nationals at Oklahoma State, and they're coming out in like two flat 300, 231 through the K. I'm like, oh my goodness. So then even at Bradley, we started to do a little bit more track interval during the cross country season, and here we do as well. We'll do our 6 week block, and then with the double threshold stuff in the spring, and then we'll do some of we're on the track at least once, maybe twice a week in the fall. So totally different to how it was. Yeah, when I ran for Joe, yeah, never on the track. We were just doing mile repeats, K's, just meat and potato type stuff, just to get aerobically stronger. But yeah, it's totally different now.
Talking about that difference, do you have like I guess like training philosophy, if you like? I appreciate that's quite a bit of a loaded question, but like in terms of, you mentioned, I guess you've got your traditional bread and butter training, you've got this flashy new Norwegian kind of double threshold, right? Where does yours sit within that? Like what do you take most inspiration from, and what would you describe as like a Darren Gorson session, right? Or an approach to training?
That's a really good question. In fact, yeah, like talking about like, trying to learn your craft and design different things. When I was at Lamar, that was a ton of fun, just doing different types of workouts. So I've always been a big Martin and Co guy and a big multi-tier. You know, Dave Campbell at Edinburgh, Chris O'Hare, Josh, me, my brother, Mark Mitchell. Hit a lot of that stuff was so much speed stuff, a lot of 300s, 200s, no, not a ton of aerobic work. And then coming to the NCAA in the early 2000s, it was, I'd never done a tempo run before. And then Joe had me doing like 8, 9, 10 mile tempo runs as a 1500 meter runner. I was dying, and hated them. I remember Josh saying the same thing. He'd do some 10 milers up here at 5,000 feet, and he was dying as well. So I think, you had the British at the time. Yeah, I don't know as much of what people do in Britain now compared to what was then, but definitely a lot more, you know, 8s and 15s at the BMC were the big thing. I can't even remember watching too many 5Ks at a BMC in the 2000 and 2005. Just like, hey, if you do the 5, there's something wrong with you in 2004, 2005. So yeah, I guess it's just kind of a mixture of some of the European stuff, some of the American system of the threshold based stuff with the base. And it's changed a lot more now. To, I remember with Stabler, we would start all our stuff with two mile threat. We didn't even call it that. It was just, hey, let's do a 2 mile at five minute pace. And then we started the workout. Whereas, and I kind of didn't do it for a while, and we've brought some of that back where, you know, we'll do 2 mile at threshold just to kick the session off. And then we'll maybe hop into some race specific stuff. And then we're finishing with something quicker. But, you know, my blocks in cross country are a little bit different. We'll have our base block where we're doing a lot of hilly long runs. We're doing those long threshold, you know, 9, 8, 9, 10 mile threshold runs on Fridays. And then on Tuesdays we're trying to get, yeah, like 7 miles of volume in with some intervals, but we're trying to do it all very lower levels. And this year for the first time we did a lot of, you know, lactate testing in the fall, trying to keep everything at L1. And then, you know, then we pull back on the length of the threshold and make it a little bit more race specific. And then on Tuesdays, things get even faster as the season goes along, so it's more specific to race pace. And then, yeah, as for the track stuff, like a typical workout for us, it might look like, it just depends on what we're getting ready for. If it's the week before, you know, we'll do something really big. You know, we went to Brian Clay and we had 9 guys break 13:40 in the 5000, and that Tuesday or Monday we just did, you know, 6 to 8 times 800 with 90 second recovery here for some of those guys to 16 down to 210, and then finish with 4 threes with 90 second recovery and 44. So nothing too complicated, but we'll definitely get into something more complex, but in the build up block to that, where we're doing a lot of multi-tier stuff in between. Like I remember Hobtum and Ishmael doing, and some of those guys doing a 2 mile, and then we did like 4 200s at 26, 190 second recovery, then a break, then we did a 1200 at like 306 longer recovery, and then we did 5 500s in 77s. And then a break, and then they did an 800, a longer break, then an 800 to finish, and then Hobtum finish. They close in 155 or 156 and 800, and then some twos to finish off. So it just depends on where we're at in the training block, and where, you know, you just can't do something like that. I think that was 2 weeks before. That's probably 2 weeks before Brian Clay, we did that workout. And then they go, you know, 1304, 1309, and so on and so forth. They're on, you know, Eker 1336, who'd never broken 14 before. Ekus from CBU goes 1337. Pama, who I'd mentioned before, he was 1419, goes 1338. Proved a ton for us. I think that's probably one thing for me where, you know, people maybe see our elites or Hoptum and Ishmael or whoever and be like, oh, that's really good. But we love the, you know, the Rikuses and Tamas and Ekers and Jadens. We're taking people, you know, Tamas was 30, 31 minutes in D2, 19, wow. He's 28, 20, and 13:37. So he's just improved, you know, a ton. So it's not just about who your best guy is. Our goal is for, you know, if our best and whoever our 15th guy is, it's just going to raise, you know, the tide raises all the boats. So if we've got 15 guys who are just all under 14 minutes, there's no room for complacency on the team if you're going to be that deep, you know?
Yeah, Jesus. I'm interested. When you get someone like Ishmael Kipkuri, Koskai, Samuel, you get these stars coming to the program. They're kind of ready-made, right? Although they're young and they obviously have huge potential, they're already competing at an NCAA kind of champion level. How quickly do you just slot them into exactly what you've just described? You know, your routine, your setup, your philosophy. Is there a part of you which just wants to go, these guys have got it right? I mean, shall I just let them crack on with what they were kind of already doing? Where do you kind of balance that?
That is a great question. And one where when we started bringing in, you know, when Pamela came in last summer, even Hoptum, I mean, how easy these guys are to coach, and they just listen and do what you ask of them is kind of a huge eye opener for me. I remember Hoptum, me being like, hey, what have you done before? We do, you know, I'm not trying to like reinvent the wheel. You're already, you know, when he got in, he was 27, 26. So I'm trying to figure out what he's done before and what we can tweak and what we can change. I remember him being in the office here and him being like, hey, you're the coach, I'm the athlete. Just tell me what I need to do and I'll do it. And if, you know, if I want to come in and, you know, there's something that's not working, we can discuss it. And, you know, we'd go back and forth a little bit in his first year, but now there's 100% buy-in on what we're doing. You know, he's gone from, you know, 27:24 is incredible. And as soon as he ran that 26:50 whatever last year, it was like, all right, hey, wherever you will need me to do it, I'm there, I'll do it. And then this year we go, you know, we went to the 10, not for a minute that I think, oh, hey, we're just going to go 1-2 on this like world-class field. And, you know, Ishmael wins, Hoptum second, and it's basically all pros around them. And they're after the race, they're like, what did you do? Or how did you get us to do that? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I don't know, but it worked. So I think, and even after that, like a few, the other guys on the team, they're like, this, like, hey, the training's crazy. I'm like, I don't know if it's that crazy. I think, you know, obviously these guys are super talented and very, very good, but I think it's, you know, it's not messing them up too. It's, you know, having a really good structure in place and communicating well with them. And, you know, if we brought in a 27:20 guy and he was running 27:50, you get crucified. If Ishmael Kipkaruri was in here as the world cross champ and he was running, you know, if he'd ran 27:30 at the 10, he probably would have dipped and, you know, wouldn't be here for very long. Now there's, you know, he loves the weather, loves the altitude, and you know, there's going to be a day where he goes pro, and you hope you're still coaching the guy when he in that position. Same with Hoptum, with Pamela, with a lot of our elites. That's the kind of the next dream for me, is like, hey, can I manage both and have a few pros? That'd be really cool.
Yeah, you just stole my question. I was just going to ask that if that was the next step, right? But look, is the NCAA kind of head coach role, is that the best coaching job in the world in terms of like in track and field, right? To be full time, you're looking after a massive team like that. Is that better than, I guess, that pro life?
Yeah, if you'd asked me, hey, do you want to coach pros like 5 years ago, 3 years ago, I would be like, no way. I have no interest in it. Just because, and I still am just obsessed with, I remember someone asked me the other day, like, hey, what was your goals or ambitions when you were like year one coach? I remember saying to Matt Rowe, I don't know if he still remembers this, but we were in Fayetteville, we're in Arkansas, and John McDonald's like idol of mine, 42 national championships, Arkansas legend, managed to talk. I remember calling him and him giving me some advice when I was going to Lamar, and thinking, hey, my goal is to win a triple crown. So cross-country nationals, indoor nationals, outdoor nationals, which is an insane goal. That's so hard to do that. But, and I remember him laughing a little bit when I said it. Still, you know, you shoot for the, what did he say? You shoot for the stars, you might land on the moon. So I've always had that drive and ambition of like, hey, I want to win a national championship in cross country, indoor and outdoor. It was cool we got fifth. You know, the men were ninth in cross country. We, you know, Joe's won a couple. There's other people I know have won a national championship. So, but if you can do both, if you can be Mike Smith where you're winning five national championships and you're coaching five, I don't know how many pros he has, 10, 15 pros, that'd be unbelievable. But it's also time too. I don't know how, you know, like I said at the start, my wife's pregnant, baby girl on the way. My wife's already like, hey, you need to put the phone down. If I'm in the UK and I'm with my brother, my mom, they're like, hey, let's put the phone down for more than 30 minutes because there's always something in my mind or someone's texting me or even on the Zoom, I've had like two or three calls. So it
Yeah.
would be hard to do it all. It'd be a ton of fun though.
Yeah, I think yeah, you've summed up coaching. You've given us an incredible insight into what it takes to be a top class NCAA coach, Darren. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me. Real pleasure.